from the lake and drink only water from the well. Morgaine said shyly, "You drank wine at Caerleon, lady?"
"Certainly, and so may you when you know the proper times to eat and drink, and the proper times to abstain," said Vivien curtly.
That silenced Morgaine, and she sat nibbling at her bread and honey. But although she was hungry, it seemed to stick in her throat.
"Have you had enough to eat?" Vivien asked. "Good. Then let Raven take the dishes. You should sleep, child. But sit here beside me before the fire, and talk a little. For tomorrow Raven will take you to the House of Maidens, and you will see me no more, save at the rites, until you are trained to take your turn with the older priestesses, to sleep in my house, and care for me as a serving woman. And at that time you too may well be under a vow of silence, neither to speak nor answer. But for tonight you are only my kinswoman, not yet vowed to the service of the goddess, and you may ask me whatever you will." She held out her hand, and Morgaine came to join her on the bench before the fire. Vivien turned and said, "Will you take the pin from my hair, Morgaine? Raven has gone to her rest, and I don't want to disturb her again." Morgaine pulled the carven pin of bone from the older woman's hair, and it came down with a rush, long and dark, with a streak of white at one temple. Vivien sighed, stretching her bare feet to the fire. "It is good to be home again. I have had to travel overmuch in late years," she said, "and I'm no longer strong enough to find it a pleasure."
"You said I might ask you questions," Morgaine said timidly. "Why do some of the women have blue signs on their brows, and others not?"
"The blue crescent is a sign that they are vowed to the service of the goddess, to live and die at her will," Vivien said.
"Those who are here only for some schooling in the sight do not take such vows." "Am I to take vows?"
"That will be your own choice," Vivien said. "The goddess will tell you whether she wishes to set her hand upon you. Only the Christians use the cloister as a kitchen midden for their unwanted daughters and widows."
"But how will I know if the goddess wants me?"
Vivien smiled in the darkness. "She will call you in a voice you cannot fail to understand. If you have heard that call, there will be nowhere in the world to hide from her voice." Morgaine wondered, but was too timid to ask, if Vivien had been vowed so.
"Of course, she is the High Priestess, the Lady of Avalon."
"I was so vowed," Vivien said quietly, with the trick she had of answering an unspoken question. "But the mark has worn away with time. If you look closely, I think you can still see a little of it at the edge of my hair there."
"Yes, a little. What does it mean to be vowed to the goddess, lady? Who is this goddess?" "I asked Father Columba once if God had any other name, and he said, no, there was only one name by which we could be saved, and that was Jesus the Christ. But..."
She broke off, abashed.
"I'm very ignorant about such things."
"To know you are ignorant is the beginning of wisdom," Vivien said. "Then, when you begin to learn, you will not have to forget all the things you think you know. God is called by many names, but is everywhere one. And so, when you pray to Mary, Mother of Jesus, you pray, without knowing it, to the World Mother in one of her many forms. The God of the priests and the Great One of the Druids is the same one, and that is why the Merlin sometimes takes his place among the Christian counsellors of the High King. He knows, if they do not, that God is one."
"Your mother was priestess here before you," my mother said.
"That is true, but it wasn't a matter of blood alone.
Rather that I had inherited her gift of the sight,
and vowed myself to the goddess of my free will. The goddess didn't call your mother, nor Morgause. So I sent Ygraine to be married to your father, and then to Uther, and Morgause to be married as the king should decree. Ygraine's marriage served the goddess. Over Morgause she had no power and no call.
Are the priestesses called by the goddess never married, then?
Usually not. They do not vow themselves to any man, except for the great marriage, where priest and priestess join in symbol of god and goddess. And children so born are children to no mortal man, but to the goddess. This is a mystery, and you will learn it at the proper time. I was so born, and have no earthly father.
Morgaine stared at her and whispered, Do you mean that your mother lay with a god?
No, of course not. Only a priest overshadowed by the power of the god. Probably a priest whose name she never knew, because at that moment, or in that time, the god came into him and possessed him, so that the man was forgotten and unknown.
Her face was distant, remembering strange things.
Morgaine could see them moving across her brow.
It seemed that the fire made pictures in the room, a great figure of a horned one.
She shivered suddenly and pulled her cloak about her. Are you weary, child? You should sleep.
But Morgaine was curious again. Were you born in Avalon?
Yes, though I was fostered on the Druid Isle, far to the north, in the islands. And when I was grown to womanhood, the goddess set her hand upon me. The blood of the priestess born ran true in me, as I think it does in you, my child.
Her voice was distant. She rose and stood looking into the fire. I'm trying to remember how many years ago it was that I came here with the old woman.
The moon was further south then, for it was harvest time, and the dark days of Samhain coming on, in the dying of the year. It was a bitter winter, even at Avalon. We heard wolves in the night, and snow lay deep, and we hungered here, for no one could make the passage through the storms. And some of the little children at the breast died when milk failed. Then the lake froze, and they brought us food on sledges. I was a maiden then. My breasts hadn't grown. And now I am old. An old woman. A crone. So many years, child.
Morgaine could feel the older woman's hand trembling. She held it hard in her own.
After a moment, Vivian drew the girl to her side and stood, her arm around her waist. So many moons, so many midsummers. And now it seems that Samhain follows hard upon Beltane Eve and more swiftly than the moon waxed from maiden to full when I was young. And you too will stand here before the fire and grow old as I have grown old, unless the mother has other tasks for you. Ah, Morgaine, Morgaine, little one, I should have left you in your mother's house.
Morgaine flung her arms fiercely around the priestess. I couldn't stay there. I would rather have died.
I knew that, Vivian said, sighing. I think the mother has laid her hand on you too, child. But you have come from a life of ease into a hard life, and a bitter one, Morgaine. And it may be that I will have tasks for you as cruel as those the Great Mother has laid on me. Now you think only of learning to use the sight, and of living in the beautiful land of Avalon. But it is no easy thing to serve the will of Ceridwen, my daughter. She is not only the Great Mother of love and birth, she is also the Lady of Darkness and Death.
Sighing, she stroked the girl's soft hair.
She is also the Morrigan, the messenger of strife, the great raven. Oh, Morgaine, Morgaine, I would you had been my own child. But even so I could not spare you. I must use you for her purposes, as I was myself used. She bowed her head, laid it for a moment on the young girl's shoulder. Believe that I love you, Morgaine, for a time will come when you will hate me as much as you love me now.
Morgaine fell impulsively to her knees. Never, she whispered. I am in the hands of the goddess. And in yours.
May she grant that you never regret those words, Vivian said.
She stretched out her hands to the fire. They were small and strong, and a little swollen with age.
With these hands I have brought children to birth, and I have seen a man's lifeblood flow from them. Once I betrayed a man to his death, a man who had lain in my arms and I had sworn to love. I destroyed your mother's peace, and now I have taken her children from her. Do you not hate and fear me, Morgaine?
I fear you, said the girl, still kneeling at her feet, her dark, intense, small face glowing with firelight. But I could never hate you. Vivian sighed deeply, thrusting away foresight and dread.
And it is not me you fear, she said, but her. We are both in her hands, child. Your virginity is sacred to the goddess. See you keep it so, till the mother makes her will known.
Morgaine laid her small hands over Vivian's. Be it so, she whispered. I swear it. The next day she went to the house of the maidens, and there she remained for many years. Morgaine speaks. How do you write of the making of a priestess? What is not obvious is secret. Those who have walked that road will know, and those who have not will never know, though I should write down all the forbidden things. Seven times Beltane Eve came and went. Seven times the winters shriveled us all with cold. The sight came easily. Vivian had said I was priestess born. It was not so easy to bid it come when I willed, and only when I willed, and to close the gates of the sight when it was not fitting I should see. It was the small magics which came hardest, forcing the mind first to walk in unaccustomed paths, to call the fire and raise it at command, to call the mists, to bring rain. All these were simple. But to know when to bring rain or mist, and when to leave it in the hands of the gods, that wasn't so simple. Other lessons there were, at which my knowledge of the sight helped me not at all. The herb lore and the lore of healing. The long songs of which not a single word might ever be committed to writing. For how can the knowledge of the great ones be committed to anything made by human hands? Some of the lessons were pure joy, for I was allowed to learn to play upon the harp, and to fashion my own, using sacred woods and the gut of an animal killed in ritual. And some lessons were of terror. Hardest of all, perhaps, to look within myself under the spell of the drugs, which loosed the mind from the body, sick and retching, while the mind soared free past the limits of time and space, and to read in the pages of the past and the future. But of that I may say nothing. At last, the day when I was cast out of Avalon, clad only in my shift, and unarmed save for the little dagger of a priestess, to return, if I could. I knew that if I did not, they would mourn me as one dead, but the gates would never again be open to me unless I could bid them open at my own will and command. And when the mists closed around me, I wandered long on the shores of the alien lake, hearing only the bells and the doleful chanting of the monks. And at last I broke through the mists and called upon her, my feet upon the earth and my head among the stars, stretching from horizon to horizon, and cried aloud the great word of power. And the mists parted, and I saw before me the same sunlit shore where the lady had brought me 7 years before. And I set my feet on the solid earth of my own home, and I wept as I had done when first I came there as a frightened child. And then the mark of the crescent moon was set between my brows by the hand of the goddess herself. But this is a mystery of which it is forbidden to write. Those who have felt their brow burned with the kiss of Ceridwen will know whereof I speak. It was in the second spring after that, when I had been released from the silence, that Galahad, who was already skilled at fighting the Saxons under his own father, King Ban of Less Britain, returned to Avalon. Chapter 12. The priestesses above a certain grade took it in turns to serve the Lady of the Lake, and at this season, when the lady was very busy with preparations for the approaching midsummer festival, one of them always slept in the little wattled house, so that the lady might have someone at her call night and day. It was so early that the sun still hid in the mist at the edge of the horizon when Vivian stepped into the room beyond her own, where her attendant slept, and beckoned quietly to awaken her. The woman sat up in bed, flinging her deerskin tunic over her undergown. "Tell the bargeman to be ready, and go and ask my kinswoman Morgaine to attend upon me." A few minutes later, Morgaine paused respectfully before the entrance where Vivian was kneeling to build up her fire. She made no sound. After 9 years of training in the priestess arts, she moved so silently that no footfall or even a breath of air marked her passing. But after those years, too, the ways of the priestesses were so well known to her that she wasn't surprised when Vivian turned as she reached the door and said, "Come in, Morgaine." Rather contrary to her usual custom, however, Vivian didn't invite her kinswoman to sit, but kept her standing there, regarding her evenly for a moment. Morgaine was not tall. She would never be that. And in these years in Avalon, she had grown as tall as she would ever be, a scant inch taller than the lady. Her dark hair was plaited down the back of her neck and wrapped with a deerskin thong. She wore the dark-dyed blue dress and deerskin over-tunic of any priestess, and the blue crescent shone darkly between her brows. Nevertheless, smooth and anonymous as she was among them, there was a glint in her eyes which answered to Vivian's cool stare, and Vivian knew from experience that, small and delicately made as she was, when she wished, she could throw a glamour over herself that made her appear not only tall, but majestic. Already she appeared ageless, and she would, Vivian knew, look much the same even when white appeared in her dark hair. She thought with a flicker of relief, "No, she isn't beautiful." Then wondered why it should matter to her. No doubt Morgaine, like all young women, even a priestess vowed lifelong to the service of the goddess, would prefer to be beautiful, and was intensely unhappy because she was not. She thought, with a slight curl of her lip, "When you are my age, my girl, it won't matter whether or no you are beautiful. For everyone you know will believe that you are a great beauty whenever you wish them to believe it. And when you do not, you can sit back and pretend to be a simple old woman long past such thoughts." She had fought her own battle more than 20 years ago, when she saw Igraine growing to womanhood with the tawny and russet beauty for which Vivian, still young, would gladly have bartered her soul and all her power. Sometimes, in moments of self-doubt, She wondered if she had thrust Igraine into marriage with Gaulois so that she needn't be endlessly taunted with the younger woman's loveliness, mocking her own dark severity. But I brought her to the love of the man destined for her before the ringstones of Salisbury Plain were piled one upon another, she thought. She realized that Morgaine was still standing quietly, awaiting her word, and smiled.
"Truly, I grow old," she said. "I was lost for a moment in memories. You are not the child who came here many years ago, but there are times when I forget it, my Morgaine."
Morgaine smiled, and the smile transformed her face, which in repose was rather sullen.
"Like Morgaine's," Vivian thought, "though otherwise they are nothing alike. It is Taliesin's blood."
Morgaine said, "I think you forget nothing, kinswoman."
"Perhaps not. Have you broken your fast, child?"
"No, but I'm not hungry."
"Very well. I want you to go in the barge."
Morgaine, who had grown used to silence, answered only with a gesture of respect and assent. It wasn't, of course, a request unusual in any way. The barge from Avalon must always be guided by a priestess who knew the secret way through the mists.
"It is a family mission," Vivian said, "for it is my son who is approaching the island, and I thought it well to send a kinswoman to welcome him here."
Morgaine smiled. "Balin," she said.
"Will his foster brother Balin not fear for his soul if he goes beyond the sound of church bells?"
A glint of humour lighted Vivian's eyes, and she said,
"Both of them are proud men and dedicated warriors, and they live blameless lives, even by the standards of the Druids, harming none and oppressing none, and ever seeking to right a wrong when they find it. I doubt not that the Saxons find them four times as fearsome when they fight side by side. In fact, they are afraid of nothing, except the evil magic of that wicked sorceress who is mother to one of them."
And she giggled like a young woman, and Morgaine giggled with her. Then, sobering, she said, "Well, I don't regret sending Balin to Fosterage in the outer world. He had no call to become a druid, and he would have made a very bad one. And if he is lost to the goddess, no doubt she will watch over him in her own way, even if he prays to her with beads and calls upon her as Mary the Virgin. No, Balin is away on the coast fighting against the Saxons at Uther's side, and I am content to have it so. It is of my younger son I spoke."
"I thought Galahad still in Brittany."
"So did I. But last night, with the sight, I saw him. He is here. When last I saw him, he was but 12 years old. He has grown considerably, I should say. He must now be 16 or more and ready for his arms. But I don't know for certain that he is to bear arms at all."
Morgaine smiled. And Vivian remembered that when Morgaine had first come here, a lonely child, she had sometimes been allowed to spend her free time with the only other child fostered here, Galahad.
"Ban of Benwick must be old now,"
Morgaine remarked.
"Old, yes. And he has many sons. So that my son, among them, is just one more of the king's unregarded bastards. But his half-brothers fear him, and would rather he went elsewhere, and a child of the great marriage cannot be treated like any other bastard."
Vivian answered the unspoken question.
"His father would give him land and estates in Brittany, but I saw to it before he was 6 years old that Galahad's heart would always be here at the lake."
She saw the glint in Morgaine's eyes and answered again the unspoken.
"Cruel, to make him ever discontent?" "Perhaps.
It wasn't I that was cruel, but the goddess. His destiny lies in Avalon, and I have seen him with the sight, kneeling before the holy chalice." Again,
with an ironic inflection. Morgain made the little gesture of assent with which a priestess under vows of silence would have acquiesced to a command. Suddenly Vivian was angry with herself. "I sit here justifying what I have done with my life and the lives of my sons to a chit of a girl? I owe her no explanations." She said, and her voice was chilled with sudden distance,
"Go with the barge, Morgain, and bring him to me."
A third time the silent gesture of assent, and Morgain turned to go.
"One moment," Vivian said. "You will break your fast here with us when you bring him back to me. He is your cousin and kinsman, too."
When Morgain smiled again, Vivian realized she had been trying to make the girl smile, and was surprised at herself. Morgain went down along the path toward the edge of the lake. Her heart was still beating faster than usual. Often these days, when she spoke with the lady, anger was mixed with affection, to neither of which she was allowed to give voice, and this did strange things to her mind. She wondered at herself, because she had been taught to control her emotions as she controlled her words, and even her thoughts. Galahad she remembered from her first years in Avalon, a scrawny, dark, intense boy. She hadn't liked him much, but because her heart hungered for her own small brother, she had let the lonely boy run about after her. Then he'd been sent away to fosterage, and she had seen him only once since, when he was 12 years old, all eyes and teeth and bones thrusting through outgrown clothes. He had grown into an intense disdain of anything female, and she had been occupied with the most difficult part of her training, so she had paid him little heed. The small dark men who poled the barge bent before her in silent respect to the goddess, whose form the higher priestesses were supposed to wear, and she signed to them without speaking, and took her place in the prow. Swiftly and silently the draped barge glided out into the mist. Morgain felt the dampness coalescing on her brow and clinging to her hair. She was hungry and chilled to the bone, but she had been taught to ignore that, too. When they came out of the mist, the sun had risen on the far shore, and she could see a horse and rider waiting there. The barge continued its slow strokes forward, but Morgain, in a rare moment of self-forgetfulness, stood unguarded, looking at the horseman there. He was slightly built, his face aquiline and darkly handsome, set off by the crimson cap with an eagle feather in its band, and the wide crimson cloak that fell gracefully around him. When he dismounted, the natural grace with which he moved, a dancer's grace, took her breath away. Had she ever wished to be fair and rounded, when dark and slender could show this beauty? His eyes were dark, too, glinting with a touch of mischief. Mischief which alone gave Morgain awareness of who this must be, although, otherwise, not a single feature remained of the scrawny boy with the bony legs and enormous feet. "Galahad," she said, pitching her voice low to keep it from trembling, a priestess trick. "I would not have recognized you." He bowed smoothly, the cape swirling as he moved. Had she ever despised that as an acrobat's trick? Here it seemed to grow from his body. "Lady," he said. "He hasn't recognized me either. Keep it so." Why at this moment did she remember Vivian's words? "Your virginity is sacred to the goddess. See you keep it so till the mother makes her will known." Startled, Morgain recognized that for the first time in her life she had looked on a man with desire, knowing that such things were not for her, but that she was to use her life as the goddess should decree. She had looked on men with scorn as the natural prey of the goddess, in the form of her priestesses, to be taken or denied as seemed right at the moment. Vivian had commanded that this year she needn't take part in the Beltane fire rituals, from which some of her fellow priestesses emerged with child by the will of the goddess, children who were either born or cast forth by the knowledge of herb lore and drugs she had been taught. An unpleasant process, which, if not followed, inevitably brought on the even more unpleasant and dangerous process of birth, and tiresome children who were reared or sent to fosterage as the lady decreed. Morgaine had been glad enough to escape this time, knowing that Vivian had other plans for her. She gestured him to step on board. "Never lay hands upon an outsider," the words of the old priestess who had schooled her. "A priestess of Avalon must be even as a visitor from the other world." She wondered why she had to stop her hand from reaching out to touch his wrist. She knew, with a sureness that made the blood beat hard in her temples, that under the smooth skin would lie hard muscle, pulsing with life, and she hungered to meet his eyes again. She turned away, trying to master herself. His voice was deep and musical as he said, "Why, now you move your hands, I know you. Everything else about you has changed. Priestess, were you not once my kinswoman called Morgaine?" The dark eyes glinted. "Nothing else is the same as when I used to call you Morgaine of the Fairies."
"I was, and I am. But years have passed," she said, turning away, gesturing to the silent servants of the barge to pole it away from the shore.
"But the magic of Avalon never changes," he murmured,
and she knew he wasn't speaking to her.
"The mist and the reeds and the cry of water birds. And then the barge, like magic, gliding from the silent shore. I know there is nothing for me here, and yet, somehow, I always return."
The barge moved silently across the lake. Even now, after years of knowing that it was no magic, but intensive training in silencing the oars, Morgaine was still impressed by the mystical silence through which they moved. She turned to call the mists, and was conscious of the young man behind her. He stood, easily balanced, beside his horse, one arm flung across the saddle blanket, shifting his weight easily without motion, so that he didn't visibly sway or lose balance as the boat moved and turned. Morgaine did this herself from long training, but he managed it, it seemed, by his own natural grace. It seemed that she could feel his dark eyes like a palpable warmth on her back as she stepped to the prow and raised her arms, the long sleeves trailing. She drew a deep breath, charging herself for the magical act, knowing she must concentrate all her strength, intensely angry at herself for her own awareness of the man's eyes on her.
"Let him see, then.
Let him fear me and know me as the goddess self." She knew some rebel part of herself, long stifled, was crying out, "No, I want him to see the woman, not the goddess, not even the priestess." But another deep breath, and even the memory of that wish was exhaled. Up went her arms into the arch of the sky. Down, with the mists following the sweep of her trailing sleeves. Mist and silence hung dark around them. Morgaine stood motionless, feeling the young man's body warmth very close to her. If she moved even a little, she would touch his hand, and knew how his hand would feel, scalding against her own. She moved away with a little swirling of her robes, and collected distance about herself, as with a veil. And all the time she was astonished at herself, saying within her mind somewhere,
This is only my cousin. It is Vivian's son who used to sit in my lap when he was little and lonely. Deliberately, she summoned the picture of that awkward boy covered with bramble scratches. But when they sailed out of the mist, the dark eyes were smiling at her, and she felt dizzy. "Of course I'm faint. I haven't yet broken my fast," she told herself, and watched the hunger in Galahad's eyes as he looked on Avalon. She saw him cross himself. Vivian would be angry if she had seen that. "It is indeed the land of the fairy folk," he said, low. "And you are Morgaine of the fairies, as always. But you are a woman now, and beautiful, kinswoman." She thought, impatient. "I'm not beautiful. What he sees is the glamour of Avalon." And something rebellious in her said, "I want him to think me beautiful. Myself, not the glamour." She set her mouth tightly and knew that she looked stern, forbidding, all priestess again. "This way," she said curtly, as the barge's bottom scraped silently on the sandy edge, signalled for the bargeman to attend to his horse. "By your leave, lady," he said. "I will attend to it myself. It is not an ordinary saddle." "As you like," Morgaine said, and stood and watched while he unsaddled his horse himself. But she was too intensely curious about everything concerning him to stand silent. "Why, it is indeed a strange saddle. What are the long leather strappings?"
"The Scythians wear them. They are called stirrups. My foster father took me on pilgrimage, and I saw them in their country. Even the Roman legions had no such cavalry, for the Scythians with these can control and stop their horses in mid-charge. And that way they can fight from horseback," he said. "And even in the light armour the horsemen wear, an equestrian knight is invincible against anyone on foot."
He smiled, the dark, intense face lighting up.
"The Saxons call me Alfgar, the elf arrow which comes out of darkness and strikes unseen. At Ban's court they have taken up the name, and call me Lancelot, which is as near as they can come to it. Some day I will have a legion of horses equipped this way, and then let the Saxons beware."
"Your mother told me you were already a warrior," Morgaine said, forgetting to pitch her voice low, and he smiled again at her.
"And now I know your voice, Morgaine of the fairies. How dare you come upon me as a priestess, kinswoman? Well, I suppose it is the lady's will. But I like you better like this than solemn as a goddess," he said, with the familiar mischief, as if they had parted but the day before.
Clasping at the shreds of her dignity, Morgaine said, "Yes, the lady awaits us, and we mustn't keep her waiting."
"Oh, yes," he mocked. "Always we must scurry to do her will. I suppose you are one of those who hurry to fetch and carry and hang trembling on her every word."
For that, Morgaine found no answer except to say, "Come this way."
"I remember the way," he said, and walked quietly at her side instead of following behind with proper respect. "I too used to run to her and wait upon her will and tremble at her frown, until I found she was not just my mother, but thought herself greater than any queen."
"And so she is," Morgaine said sharply.
"No doubt. But I have lived in a world where men do not come and go at a woman's beckoning."
She saw that his jaw was set, and that the mischief was gone from his eyes.
"I would rather have a loving mother than a stern goddess whose every breath bids men live and die at her will."
To that, Morgaine found nothing whatever to say. She set a swift pace that meant he must scurry at her heels to keep up. Raven, still silent, for she had bound herself by vows of perpetual silence, save when she spoke tranced as a prophetess, let them into the dwelling with an inclination of the head. As her eyes adjusted to the dimness, Morgaine saw that Vivian, seated by the fire, had chosen to greet her son not in the ordinary dark dress and deerskin tunic of a priestess, but had put on a dress of crimson and done her hair high on her forehead with gems glittering there. Even Morgaine, who knew the tricks of glamour for herself, gasped at the magnificence of Vivian. She was like the goddess welcoming a petitioner to her underworld shrine. Morgaine could see that Galahad's chin was set, and that the cords in his knuckles stood out white against his dark fists. She could hear him breathing, and guessed at the effort with which he steadied his voice as he rose from his bow.
"My lady and mother, I give you greeting."
"Galahad," she said, "come, sit here beside me."
He took a seat across from her instead. Morgaine hovered near the door, and Vivian beckoned her to come and seat herself too.
"I waited to break fast with you both. Here, join me."
There was fresh cooked fish from the lake, scented with herbs and dripping butter. There was hot, fresh barley bread and fresh fruit, such food as Morgaine seldom tasted in the austere dwelling of the priestesses. She and Vivian, too, ate sparingly, but Galahad helped himself to everything with the healthy hunger of a youth still growing.
"Why, you have set a meal fit for a king, mother. How does your father? And how does Brittany?"
"Well enough, though I haven't spent much time there in the last year. He sent me on a far journey to learn for his court about the new cavalry of the Scythian peoples. I don't think even the soldiers of Rome, such as they are, have any such horsemen now. We have herds of Iberian horses, but you are not interested in the doings of the stud farms. Now I have come to bring word to the Pendragon's court of a new massing of Saxon armies. I doubt not they will strike in full force before midsummer. Would that I had time and enough gold to train a legion of these horsemen."
"You love horses," Vivian said in surprise.
"Does that surprise you, madam? With beasts you always know precisely what they think, for they cannot lie nor pretend to be other than they are," he said.
"The ways of nature will all be open to you," Vivian said, "when you return to Avalon in the life of a druid." He said, "Still the same old song, lady. I thought I gave you my answer when last I saw you."
"Galahad," she said, "you were 12 years old. That is too young to know the better part of life."
He moved his hand impatiently.
"No one calls me Galahad now, save you alone, and the druid who gave me that name. In Brittany and in the field, I am Lancelot."
She smiled and said,
"Do you think I care for what the soldiers say? So you would bid me sit still in Avalon and play the harp, while outside in the real world the struggle goes on for life and death, my lady?"
Vivian looked angry.
"Are you trying to say this world is not real, my son?"
"It is real," said Lancelot, with an impatient movement of his hand, "but real in a different way, cut off from the struggle outside. Fairyland, eternal peace. Oh, yes, it is home to me. You saw to that, lady.
But it seems that even the sun shines differently here. And this is not where the real struggles of life are taking place. Even the Merlin has the wit to know that. The Merlin came to be as he is through years when he learned to know the real from the unreal," said Vivian. "And so must you. There are warriors enough in the world, my son. Yours is the task to see further than any, and perhaps to bid the warriors come and go."
He shook his head.
"No, lady, say no more. That path is not mine." "You are still not grown to know what you want," Vivian said flatly. "Will you give us 7 years, as you gave your father, to know whether this is your road in life?" "'In 7 years,' said Lancelot, smiling, "'I hope to see the Saxons driven from our shores, "'and I hope to have a hand in their driving. "'I have no time for the magics and mysteries of the Druids, lady, "'and would not if I could. "'No, my mother, I beg you to give me your blessing "'and send me forth from Avalon. "'For to tell the truth, lady, I will go with your blessing or without it.' I have lived in a world where men do not wait for a woman's bidding to go and come.
Morgaine shrank away as she saw the white of rage sweep over Vivian's face. The priestess rose from her seat, a small woman, but given height and majesty by her fury.
"You defy the Lady of Avalon, Galahad of the Lake?"
He didn't shrink before her. Morgaine, seeing him pale under the dark tanning of his skin, knew that inside the softness and grace was steel to match the lady's own. He said quietly, "Had you bidden me this when I still starved for your love and approval, madam, no doubt I would have done even as you commanded. But I am not a child, my lady and mother, and the sooner we acknowledge that, then the sooner we shall be in harmony and cease from quarrelling. The life of a druid is not for me."
"Have you become a Christian?" she asked, hissing with anger.
He sighed and shook his head.
"Not really. Even that comfort is denied me, though in Ban's court I could pass as one when I wished. I think I have no faith in any god but this."
He laid his hand on his sword. The lady sank down on her bench and sighed. She drew a long breath and then smiled.
"So," she said, "you are a man, and there is no compelling you. Although I wish you would speak of this to the Merlin."
Morgaine, watching unregarded, saw the tension relax in the young man's hands. She thought, "He thinks she has given way. He does not know her well enough to know that she is angrier than ever." Lancelot was young enough to let the relief show in his voice.
"I'm grateful to you for understanding, madam, and I will willingly seek counsel of the Merlin if it pleases you. But even the Christian priests know that a vocation to the service of God is God's gift, and not anything that comes because one wants it or does not. God, or the gods, if you will, has not called me, or even given me any proof that he, or they, exist."
Morgaine thought of Vivian's words to her many years ago. It is too heavy a burden to be borne unconsenting. But for the first time she wondered, what would Vivian really have done if at any time during these years I had come to her and told her that I wished to depart? The lady is all too sure that she knows the will of the goddess. Such heretical thoughts disturbed her, and quickly she thrust them from her mind, resting her eyes again on Lancelot. At first she had only been dazzled by his dark handsomeness, the grace of his body. Now she saw specific things. The first down of beard along his chin. He hadn't time, or hadn't chosen, to shave his face in the Roman fashion. His slender hands exquisitely shaped, fashioned for harp strings or weapons, but calloused just a little across palm and the insides of the fingers, more on the right hand than the left. There was a small scar on one forearm, a whitish seam that looked as if it had been there for many years, and another, crescent-shaped, on the left cheek. His lashes were as long as a girl's, but he didn't have the androgynous boy-girl look of many boys before their beards have grown. He was like a young stag. Morgaine thought she had never seen so masculine a creature before. Because her mind had been trained to such thoughts, she thought, there is nothing of the softness of a woman's training in him to make him pliable to any woman. He has denied the touch of the goddess in himself. One day he will have trouble with her. And again her mind leapt, thinking that one day she would play the role of the goddess at one of the great festivals. And she thought, feeling a pleasant heat in her body, would that he might be the god. Lost in her daydream, she didn't hear what Lancelot and the lady were saying until she was recalled by hearing Vivian speak her name, and she came back to herself as if she had been wandering somewhere out of the world.
"Morgaine," the lady repeated.
"My son has been long away from Avalon. Take him away. Spend the day on the shores, if you will. You are freed for this day from duties. When you were children both, I remember you liked it well to walk on the shores of the lake. Tonight, Galahad, you shall sup with the Merlin, and shall be housed among the young priests who are not under the silence. And tomorrow, if you still wish for it, you shall go with my blessing."
He bowed profoundly, and they went out. The sun was high, and Morgaine realized that she had missed the sunrise salutations. Well, she had the lady's permission to absent herself, and in any case, she was no longer one of the younger priestesses, for whom the missing of such a service was a matter for penances and guilt. Today she had intended to supervise a few of the younger women in preparing dyes for ritual robes. Nothing that couldn't wait another day, or a handful of days. "I will go to the kitchens," she said, "and fetch us some bread to take with us. We can hunt for waterfowl, if you like. Are you fond of hunting?"
He nodded and smiled at her.
"Perhaps if I bring my mother a present of some waterfowl, she will be less angry with me." "I would like to make my peace with her," he said, almost laughing. "When she is angry, she is still frightening."
"When I was little, I used to believe that when I wasn't with her, she took off her mortality and was the goddess indeed."
"But I should not speak like that about her. I can see that you are very devoted to her."
"She has been as devoted to me as a foster mother," Morgaine said slowly.
"Why shouldn't she be? She's your kinswoman, is she not? Your mother, if I recall rightly, was the wife of Cornwall, and is now the wife of the Pendragon. Is it so?"
Morgaine nodded. It had been so long that she could only half remember Igraine, and now sometimes it seemed to her that she had been long motherless. She had learned to live without the need of any mother, save the goddess, and she had many sisters among the priestesses, so she had no need of any earthly mother. "I have not seen her for many years."
"I saw Uther's queen but once, from a distance. She's very beautiful, but she seems cold and distant too."
Lancelot laughed uneasily.
"At my father's court, I grew used to women who were interested only in pretty gowns and jewels, and their little children, and sometimes, if they weren't married, in finding a husband. I don't know much about women. You aren't like them either. You seem unlike any woman I've ever known."
Morgaine felt herself blushing. She said low, reminding him, "I'm a priestess like your mother."
"Oh," he said, "but you are as different from her as night from day. She is great and terrible and beautiful, and one can only love and adore and fear her. But you, I feel you are flesh and blood, and still real, in spite of all these mysteries around you. You dress like a priestess, and you look like one of them. But when I look into your eyes, I see a real woman there whom I could touch."
He was laughing and intense, and she thrust her hands into his and laughed back at him.
"Oh, yes, I'm real as the ground under your feet, or the birds in that tree."
They walked together down by the waterside, Morgaine leading him along a little path, carefully skirting the edges of the processional way.
"Is it a sacred place?" he asked. "Is it forbidden to climb the Tor, unless you are a priestess or a druid?"
"Only at the great festivals is it forbidden," she said. "And you may certainly come with me. I may go where I will. There's no one on the Tor now except sheep grazing. Would you like to climb it?"
"Yes," he said.
"I remember once when I was a child I climbed it.
I thought it was forbidden, so I was sure that if anyone knew I had been there, I would be punished. I still remember the view from the height. I wonder if it was as enormous as it seemed to me when I was a little lad."
"We can climb the processional way, if you will. It isn't so steep, because it winds round and round the Tor, but it is longer."
"No," he said. "I would like to climb straight up the slope. But..." he hesitated. "Is it too long and steep for a girl? I have climbed in rougher country, hunting, but can you manage in your long skirts?"
She laughed, and told him that she had climbed it often.
"And as for the skirts, I'm used to them," she said. "But if they get into my way, I will not hesitate to tuck them up above my knees."
His smile was slow and delightful.
"Most women I know would think themselves too modest to show their bare legs."
Morgaine flushed.
"I've never thought modesty had much to do with bared legs for climbing. Surely men know that women have legs like their own. It cannot be so much of an offence of modesty to see what they must be able to imagine.
I know some of the Christian priests speak so. But they seem to think the human body is the work of some devil, not of God, and that no one could possibly see a woman's body without going all into a rage to possess it."
He looked away from her, and she realized that beneath the outward assurance he was still shy, and that pleased her. Together they set off upward,
Morgaine, who was strong and hardy from much running and walking, setting a pace which astonished him, and which, after the first few moments, he found it difficult to match.
About halfway up the slope, Morgaine paused, and it was a definite satisfaction to her to hear him breathing hard when her own breath still came easily, unforced. She wound the loose folds of her skirt up around her waist, letting only a single drape hang to her knees, and went on along the steeper, rockier part of the slope. She had never before had the slightest hesitation in baring her legs. But now, when she knew he was looking at them, she couldn't keep from remembering that they were shapely and strong, and she wondered if he really thought her immodest after all. At the top, she climbed up over the rim of the hill and sat down in the shadow of the ringstones. A minute or two later, he came over the edge behind her, and flung himself down, panting. When he could speak again, he said,
"I suppose I've been riding too much, and not walking and climbing enough. You aren't even short of breath."
"Well, but I'm accustomed to coming up here, and I don't always stop to go round by the processional way," she said.
"And on the priest's aisle, there isn't even a shadow of the ringstones," he said, and pointed.
"No," she said. "In their world, there is only their church and its tower. If we wanted to listen with the ears of the spirit, we could hear the church bells. They are shadows here, and in their world, we should be shadows. I sometimes wonder if that is why they avoid the church and keep great fasts and vigils on our holy days, because it would be too uncanny to feel all around them the shadow of the ringstones, and perhaps even, for those who still had some shadow of the sight, to feel and sense all around them the comings and goings of the druids, and hear the whisper of their hymns."
Lancelot shivered, and it seemed that a cloud covered the sun for a moment.
"And you have the sight?"
You can see beyond the veil that separates the worlds.
Everyone has it,
Morgaine said.
But I am trained to it beyond most women.
Would you see, Galahad?
He shivered again and